Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and tonight with a guest host, Emma Hart. Now, Emma has come in today to do some work experience. She was going to help me produce the show, but Padraig Reedy, who was going to host the show, is ill. So basically, I'm making Emma work for the experience. So Emma is now going to introduce our guest tonight, who is Connor Woodman.
Connor Woodman is an economist, author, and presenter. His passion is to unreal global economic issues in an accessible way, with a sense of fun and adventure. Connor is the author of Around the World in 80 Trades, which had an accompanying television series for Channel 4. His latest book is Unfair Trade, How Big Business Exploits the World's Poor, and Why It Doesn't Have To. So, the book is called Unfair Trade. So what do you mean by unfair trade?
Well, obviously it's a play on fair trade. What does fair trade mean is a good question, because we understand fair trade, I think, in a couple of different ways. It's fair trade with a capital F, which is the Fair Trade Foundation as it exists in the UK, which is the NGO with the little kind of yin-yang symbol that they put on coffee and chocolate bars in supermarkets. We've all seen it. But I think there's a bigger concept, which is fair trade with a small f, if you like, which is just the idea that people that produced goods that we buy in the high street have produced them in such a way as they're not being exploited, their lives are not being threatened, the wages that they're earning are enough to live on, that they're selling the stuff that they produce or grow for more than they produced it for. And I kind of became interested in, I guess, why we needed to have something called the Fair Trade Foundation, why that concept of fair trade with a small f kind of had to become branded, if you like.
So this, you talk about this idea that the Fair Trade Foundation, that's, like you said, the sort of kite mark that you see on products, and also there's another organisation, the Rainforest Alliance, which is probably less well known in this country, but these have basically become brands. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, they've become brands in association with lots of familiar brands that we already know. So it's hard to think now of a brand producing food or beverages that haven't associated themselves with these brands. You know, if you think of McDonald's, Nestle, Cadbury's, Starbucks, they're all either Fairtrade, Rainforest Alliance, or so they appear. I think when you actually scratch beneath the surface a little bit, you see that most of these big brands, what they've done is they've picked one product in their product range and they've sought certification for that. And what that's actually meant is that the Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade brands have become a lot more visible on the high street because they're kind of piggybacking on the reputations, I guess, of the bigger brands that they've got into bed with. So it's a very kind of symbiotic relationship between the certification organisations and the retail organisations.
But you sort of paint a picture of almost almost a marketing thing, in that the brand itself is marketing itself, is what I'm sort of trying to get to. So there is an office of the Fair Trade Foundation where people, you know, are working, where they're trying to, you know, they're promoting a concept rather than the actual products further down the line, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. The stated purpose of the Fair Trade Foundation, let's be clear, they say, is to widen the recognition of the Fair Trade brand. Mm-hmm. That's what they exist to do. So, yes, of course, what underlies that is a concept and a mechanism. So Fairtrade, for example, let's look at, operates in two different ways. It says to a wholesaler, let's say your Starbucks or your McDonald's or Nestle or whatever it is, if you're buying cocoa for chocolate or you're buying coffee, then you need to pay a minimum guaranteed price. and they set those minimum guaranteed prices. And then on top, you need to pay a social premium, which is a little percentage on top of the price that you pay, which goes to generally a cooperative or a big estate from which you're buying those goods. And so that's the mechanism that's supposed to represent their idea of how best to achieve what we just talked about, fair trade, with a small f.
So there's a really great example that you talk about, Cadbury's, and Cadbury's getting the fair trade certification for their dairy milk bars. But what's interesting is that Cadbury's already had a really great sort of similar ethical project going on. So, tell us first of all what that project was.
Yeah, this was kind of the project that Cadbury's run is called the Cocoa Initiative, and there's a real problem in West Africa where most of Cadbury's chocolate comes from. In fact, most of the chocolate in the world comes from West Africa, and most farmers are smallholders, little farmers growing small amounts of cocoa, and the worry is that the kids of these farmers are not also going to go into farming. They prefer to go to the city and get jobs in factories and, you know, and follow the dream. And if everyone does that, then in 10, 15, 20 years' time, there's going to be no one left growing cocoa. And, oh my God, where are we going to get our chocolate bars from? This is an emergency. So what Cadbury's, for example, have done is they've come up with a scheme whereby they put £45 million over 10 years. And they're kind of in the middle of this at the moment. They're fully committed to it, still doing it. About £4.5 million a year goes back into the communities where cocoa's been grown in Ghana. And the idea is to educate. The idea is to provide better seed crops. The idea is to build wells and schools and contribute to these villages to make them the sort of places that farmers' kids want to stay and continue farming in. Sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the kind of sustainable initiative that I think is really cool. What I was a little bit surprised about was that Cadbury's had also gone for fair trade certification for one of their chocolate bars for the dairy milk bar, and I went to the launch of that. And when I got there, the Cadbury's boardroom was absolutely packed full of journalists. I mean, there were journalists everywhere. Everybody wanted to know about the fact that Cadbury's were going fair trade. And yet no one seemed to know anything about this kind of sustainable cocoa initiative that they were already running. And I thought, well maybe it's a size thing, you know. So then I started just kind of drilling through the numbers. And this is where I found the whole fair trade thing started to unravel a little bit for me. Because if you look at the minimum price guarantee, let's say for cocoa, at the time, $1,600 a ton. So by signing up for fair trade, Cadbury's were saying to the cocoa farmers, we're not going to pay less than $1,600 a ton. Okay. The problem is that the market price for cocoa is around $3,000 a ton. So the farmers are saying, oh, yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, you're not going to pay us less than half what we're already selling it for. Yeah, we could have worked that one out for ourselves. So really, what are you going to pay us? And so really, all that Cadbury's are having to pay on top is that little bit of social premium. And if you work that out, it's about $150 per ton, and you kind of work that back. That's kind of, you know, $1.50 per 100 grams, and you work it back to, there's about 30% cocoa in a chocolate bar. Work it back. It's about half a cent per bar. It's a drop in the ocean compared to what they were already putting into their sustainable initiative. But none of the journalists cared about the sustainable initiative. What all the journalists cared about was fair trade. So it does look like a great marketing exercise on the part of Cadbury's.
And how the marketing exercise as a business, in your book you talk about how the logo is only for making the customers feel good about themselves.
Well, this is the obvious question, is to, you know, why are all those journalists there? Why are they interested in the fair trade story? You know, journalists are selling newspapers, and they're selling newspapers to us. So they obviously think there's a demand there for customers who buy dairy milk chocolate bars to want to know about this fair trade initiative. And certainly when I was there, journalists weren't the only people in the room. There were also a number of... it's funny because I was in Birmingham, and I'm from Birmingham, where people quite often use the word fab. And there were lots of people sitting around the room with these T-shirts with the word fab written across, and I thought it was this kind of weird Brummy fashion statement. And actually it wasn't. It's the Fair Trade Association of Birmingham. But they were there, and they were so overjoyed that that Cadbury's had made this decision, and it was something kind of cultish about it, and people were kind of, you know, woohoo, and you know, this is great, and you know by eating chocolate we can save, you know, Africa. And I was thinking, there's such a disconnect here between what is really happening and what people's perception of what's happening is. And I think people are really keen to get behind a campaign that sounds great, but perhaps they don't have the inclination to kind of go behind the numbers and see whether things really stack up.
But this is what's such a great example about this is, you know, if this was another company, you could quite easily dismiss this as a sort of greenwash thing. You know, it's clearly a marketing exercise. But Cadbury's, which is an organisation that was, you know, set up under quite ethical principles by Quakers once upon a time in the past, is clearly doing something demonstrable that is great and fantastic, has a really great, you know, ethical thing that it should be sort of promoting, and yet in some respects it isn't, because this seems the easier way to, you know, to get sort of like marketing mileage out of the fair trade movement.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, Cadbury's, you know, they built all the social housing in Bourneville, you know, that's still there today, that was built for their workers. They've got a really proud history in terms of social responsibility, you know, corporate social responsibility. They're one of the first companies to take that seriously. And what I was a little bit frustrated by, because they obviously still have this sense of responsibility, but what I became a bit frustrated by is the way that these marks are kind of stealing the limelight and taking over the agenda. And that kind of led me on, I suppose, to think about the other markets, you know, markets where ethical certification doesn't exist. And, you know, what is the connection really between these big companies and the people at the other end of the supply chain that produce the inputs for their goods? Because it goes way beyond anything that Fair Trade or Rainforest Alliance or these other kind of third-party labelling organisations can cover. This is the global economy we're talking about.
On quite a small scale, you talk about a couple of little companies, a tea producing company and a coffee producing company. And Ethical Addictions and the Rare Tea Company, I'm going to name them. We should really be promoting these companies, should we, seeing that they are doing good things. Although I should probably say that other ethical coffee and tea producing companies probably exist. I don't know. go and look them up. But let's talk about these sort of examples, because these are great examples of companies that. Well, you tell us what they're doing. What are they doing that's good?
Yeah, I mean, before I start, I mean, I'll say these are quite small companies. Now, both of these companies I highlighted in the book as examples, as you said, of many small companies who I think are starting to emerge, making profits, of course, because every business needs to make money, otherwise it's out of business, but making profits with a kind of sense of ethical responsibility at their core values. Ethical Addictions were a company who import coffee from around the world and who don't seek third-party labelling for their coffee. They have a relationship that's direct to their customers, which says, look, this is where we're buying this coffee from. So we're going to go to Brazil, we're going to go to Tanzania, we're going to go to Vietnam. We're actually going to source coffee in a really responsible way, and we're going to tell you the story behind where we get that coffee from. And I actually traced some of the coffee that they bought back to a hillside community in Tanzania, who previously had been selling all of their coffee to a cooperative who, funnily enough, were fair trade certified. And even though the fair trade minimum price in Tanzania at the time was about, let's say it was $2.30 a kilo, these people in the village were getting $1, $1.50 tops for their coffee. Kind of thinking, well, this isn't very good. You know, where's the money that's going into the cooperative should be going back to the farmers, and it's not. So there's one issue there. You've got a system that's not actually working to the benefit of the farmers. But the flip side was that when the guys from Ethical Addictions went along, they went and tasted the coffee in the village, went along to see the villagers, said, get it out, let's see it, let's taste it, it's great. And they said, this stacks up as one of the best coffees that we buy from Africa. This is, we can sell this to our customers. You know, the quality is great. And so they said to the villagers, how much? And they told them. So they said, well, I'll tell you what, instead of you taking $1.50 a kilo, we'll give you $4 per kilo for this coffee. And the villagers were kind of quiet for a second, and then they went off and they came back with a kilo bag of coffee, and they said, there you go, that'll be $4. And they said, they had to explain to them, no, we don't want 1 kilo, we want all of your coffee. And there was just silence. Nobody knew what to say for a couple of minutes. And I went to this village and said, what was that like? And they said, well, it's great. It's completely, it's inspired us to kind of take production of our coffee more seriously. We're now planting more coffee. We've got the money now to build, a facility for washing and cleaning the coffee. And so they've become really empowered, not through having an ethical labelling certificate, but through producing a good quality product that can be sold into. And as I said at the start, this is a niche market. But the tea company they looked at were operating in a very similar way. And I thought it was quite inspiring that in places like Africa, actually what serves people better is to produce better quality stuff.
But of course, if I'm going to Waitrose and I'll see this coffee from Ethical Addictions or whoever against another coffee that has the Fair Trade Foundation mark on it, I'm more likely to buy that one. I'm more likely to think that because that mark exists.
Yeah,
is obviously a shame. It's obviously a shame that
it does put an enormous responsibility on consumers to look beyond the labels, of course. But that's why I kind of wrote this book. Is there are so many areas where labels don't even exist, and what I kind of find frustrating is that companies don't actually take a lead on this. I think what Fairtrade and Rainforest Alliance, to give them their dues, what they've done a very good job of is making you aware of that there is an ethical issue. You're aware of the brand. You're looking for the brand because you know that there must be some coffee and some chocolate that's not being sourced very ethically, and there must be some more that is being sourced more ethically. What I would prefer to see brands do, bigger brands and Ethical Addictions, is actually operate in the way that Ethical Addictions do and make that connection themselves, so that I can go into Waitrose and I can look at my favourite brand and know that they are sourcing their coffee according to those kind of ethical credentials without needing anyone else to go and certify it for them.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and with Emma Hart, and we're talking to Connor Woodman about his book Unfair Trade. So, Connor, we've just there been talking about a couple of examples of where a sort of more equitable fair trade model is being carried out. But obviously these are tiny, almost one-man operations, personally going out and sort of dealing with individual farmers. But you also talk in the book about the Côte d'Ivoire and their cotton production and how there's a... I can't remember the name of the company, a multinational company.
Olam, one of the companies that you've never heard of, and their turnover is about $10 billion a year. There are so many of these companies. They're supply chain companies that Olam source cotton for Gap, coffee for Starbucks, chocolate for Nestle. They're across everything. They're one of these companies who go out and buy the stuff that gets turned into the stuff we buy. And so their influence is enormous in terms of our relationship as customers with third world producers. And I went to Côte d'Ivoire. It was really bad timing because they'd just had their presidential election, which returned two presidents, both of whom who discredited each other and tried to seize power. So it was a bit crazy there at the time, off the back of their own civil war. This election was supposed to resolve, on the verge of another civil war. And yet somehow this company, Olam, was still managing to operate. So I kind of smuggled myself in across the border at Burkina Faso and went down to the cotton fields. And briefly, the story there is Olam bought an old gin. When you grow cotton, you have to have a gin nearby because it needs to be separated. The seed needs to be separated from the lint. The lint gets turned into clothes. And so, because it's bulky and it's hard to transport, if you're a little African farmer, you need to have a gin nearby. And whoever controls the gin controls the supply. And most of the farmers in that part of West Africa had been ripped off consistently over the last 6 to 8 years, often not being paid for their cotton for months on end, or sometimes not being paid at all. A lot of them have given up growing cotton altogether. Then Olam came in and said, do you know what, we're going to invest in cotton here. So we're going to do up the gin, which costs them about $5 million. We're going to go back to the farmers and say, look, we want you to go back to growing cotton. We're going to give you good quality seeds, good fertilisers, good pesticides, and education how to use these things. And we hope you're going to increase your yield and increase your productivity of good quality cotton that we can gin and we can sell. Well, I went there 2 years into this project that was running, and it was running really well. And it was incredible to see a transformation of an agricultural community who'd gone back to a product they'd almost completely given up. They were making money from it, and it's their only cash crop there, so that's surplus money that they can spend on other things than just staples. And Olam were getting rich from it as well. So you could see that this was just going to run and run and run, and everybody's happy. And that, for me, was a perfect example of a sustainable business practice. You know, the company aren't doing this out of the goodness of their own heart, they're doing it to make money. But the side effect is that smallholders are also profiting, and nobody's getting exploited. Why can't all business operate like mm-hmm. that?
So we've been talking about fair trade as a sort of concept that we all understand, which is about giving a producer a fair price for a product. But of course, another side of this as well is the conditions that workers often work in other parts of the world that are supplying the West with goods. And you travel to in the book various places and, well, experience yourself sometimes the conditions that these workers are under. And I would like to talk particularly about the example of Nicaragua and the lobster fishermen. So tell us what was going on there.
Yeah, the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, to give it a little bit of political background, the indigenous people are called Mosquito people, Mosquito with an ISK, not named after the insect, but named after the coast there. And they're the indigenous people who fought on the side of the Contras against the Sandinistas, and now we have a Sandinista government, so they're the kind of forgotten people of Nicaragua. And there really is only one industry that operates down that coast, and it's lobster. And most of the lobster gets shipped to the United States, where obviously there's enormous demand through restaurant chains like the Red Lobster Company. And the only real way of catching lobsters is to dive for them. You can do it through pots, but pots are very expensive. So what happens along that Caribbean coast is people dive for them. Now, if I don't know if you or any of your listeners are scuba divers, but when you do your scuba diving certificate, safety is the thing that you spend all your time kind of learning about. And I've done it, and I know I've had this drilled into me: 3 dives a day is your limit. Okay, and you need to do appropriate safety stops in between so that the nitrogen in your blood can get out. Otherwise, you get the bends, and the bends is really nasty. You know, you lose a limb. At worst, you can die. Well, the Nicaraguan fishermen, the divers who dive for these lobsters, I dived with them. I spent time living out on the boats with them and sitting and going down with them. I saw people diving 10, 11, 12 times a day to depths of 30 metres, 100 feet, doing no decompression stops, literally going down with the tank, coming back up when it runs out of air because they have no gauges. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's so terrible. They have no gauges, they have no safety training, they've rubbish equipment. And surprise, surprise, they lose 50 young men every year down this coast, die, and hundreds more end up with the bends. And on the boats, you'll look around and you just see young men limping. You go back into the town and there are young men leaning up against walls with crutches. There are people going around in homemade wheelchairs. I mean, it's like an epidemic of the bends. You know, and this is not a contagious disease. This is a preventable condition with a little bit of training and some rudimentary equipment. So there's a massive disconnect here between people eating their $20 lobster supper in a restaurant in Florida or Los Angeles and these communities along the Nicaraguan coast. And you've got to ask the question, well, why? Why does this exist?
Well, you talk about how these lobster companies, the restaurant companies, are, you know, they have started to take notice of the fact that they have to have some form of corporate responsibility, and they will proudly put on their menus that their lobsters are not caught in this way, but are caught in traps.
Well, on their menus, what they talk about is actually their conservation of reef marine life, which is great. They're conserving fish stocks,
yeah,
so but not diver stocks.
Yeah, into projects.
Yeah, as though it's some kind of ethical set-off system that's operating. It's crazy. When questioned on it, they say that they never knowingly buy dive caught lobster, and that they use a system of middlemen who are told that they must only use trap caught lobster, but they have no system of auditing in place. They used to give some money to an NGO who weren't very effective and have since stopped operating in Nicaragua. And it's this argument of plausible deniability of, you know, well, our suppliers must be letting us down, and therefore it's not our fault. And I find this terribly frustrating, as though outsourcing production is also outsourcing responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a major issue that runs right through the book, actually, is big companies, big business operating in one territory and almost turning a blind eye to human rights that operate at the other end of their own supply mm-hmm. chains in another territory.
Well, you talk in the book about various other areas. One, something that we've talked about on the show before, so we won't go into, is the Congo and the hunt for coltan and those sort of conditions. But the other thing spectre, if that's the right word, that basically hovers over the entire book,
the C word,
is China. Yes, indeed. And first of all, you know, you talk about the idea that, you know, a lot of the outsourcing of electrical equipment is done in China. So, like, you know, Apple and Sony and whatever have their stuff done there, and you can't really tell where that's just coming from. But also, what I think is sort of more interesting is that China sort of, it's not going to care about this stuff in the same way that we do. So are we, in some respects, is the sort of our quest to get Western businesses to behave in a more ethical way, is that down the line just going to be a bad business practice for them when they're trying to compete with China, who is, you know, fast becoming the world's greatest superpower?
Well, I think there is a real problem, in that we have this colonial past that we're very guilty of and we're very sensitive about when we operate in former colonial territories, and China definitely operates without such ghosts, and they often are, the door is open to Chinese companies to invest in these countries because we are dallying about whether we should not put money into the Congo, whether we should not go near our old territories. And I think that does the people in those countries a real disservice, because I think, as you say, the evidence that I collected and observe in the book is that Chinese companies are definitely operating in ways that we would deem unacceptable and unethical. For me, that is a kind of real danger, especially when you look across the investment community at the moment and say, well, who's got the money to invest? It's not us.
We're out of time. So we've been talking to Connor Woodman about his book Unfair Trade, How Big Business Exploits the World's Poor and Why It Doesn't Have To. Connor, thank you for coming and talking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.